Welcome to After the End from the Ethos Centre at the University of Oxford, funded by the Wellcome Discovery Awards Scheme. I'm Patricia Kingori, Professor of Global Health Ethics at the University of Oxford. In this series, we explore endings and their aftermaths. Who decides when an end has been reached? Whether the end for one person is the end for everybody, and what happens after these so-called endings. In this podcast, we hear from theoretical physicist Felix Flicker from Bristol University on whether time exists and living after the end of the universe.
I'm a senior lecturer in physics at Bristol University, and I work on quantum materials, so looking at the effects of quantum mechanics in matter. I was invited to the After the End workshop by Patricia Kingori, which I was very excited about. It's something very different to what I've usually done. So Patricia and I had a preliminary discussion. She asked me what I thought about time and how do physicists think about time. And I told her that I wasn't really convinced time exists. And that when I'd started my PhD, I'd said this to somebody and they told me to go and speak to Tony Short, who's a physicist in the department, because he was well known for believing that time does exist. So the sense in which we think it doesn't is that if you look at what appears in your equations and what you actually do in physics, you tend to refer to events, instances in time, as an assumption that you flow between those events, but that never really features in your physical theories. And so should we drop things that aren't actually necessary in theories? And if we should, then probably we should drop this assumption that things flow between events. The bits of the talk I gave that are undisputed are that Albert Einstein, in inventing special relativity, made us think quite carefully about the nature of space and time. And the way you do these calculations in reality is that you split things up into space-time events. So you say this thing happened at this point in space and this point in time, like the third floor of a building at these city coordinates at 10:53 a.m. or something like that. These are the things you refer to when you're doing your calculations. And then we assume that things flow between those different events. But that's never actually required in the calculations you're doing. At the After the End workshop, I did discuss some of this gas-in-the-box idea that's frankly quite speculative and is really a sort of thought experiment. But I thought it fit well with the theme of the workshop, since that was about what happens after the end of things. I'd come up with a sort of paradoxical scenario involving a gas in a box and trying to imagine what it would be like if this gas spontaneously fluctuated in such a way that it became ordered enough for consciousness to come into existence. From a physics point of view, the idea I had was essentially that you could explain certain major outstanding paradoxes in physics if we assume that we actually live after the end of the universe, in the sense that we've already reached the heat death of the universe where everything is maximally disordered. But we're living in a random fluctuation away from that where order spontaneously generates temporarily. So there are theories along these lines. My addition to that was to say, well, in a sense, that's the most likely scenario. But also, if consciousness came about in this process, it might always deduce that it had come not from the end of the universe, but from the start at a big bang. And that's exactly what we believe. This idea of splitting things up into events and special relativity in particular. The issue is that depending on one's relative velocity compared to something, concepts such as space or time in themselves can be quite malleable. There's an example called the ladder paradox, which says that imagine you're stood still and there's a ladder flying towards you, and the ladder is 10 feet long, if it's still compared to you. If it travels sufficiently fast, we realize that it will appear to you to be 8 feet long, say, at the appropriate speed. So lengths contract as things move relative to you, and also times dilate. So the ladder, according to all measurements you can make, really will be 8 feet long. So if you had a barn that's 8 feet long and a ladder that's 10 feet long when stationary, if you then make it so that the ladder's moving very quickly relative to the barn, you can make it so that the ladder fits inside the barn. So that already seems quite paradoxical, but actually it gets much worse because everything is relative, motion is relative. So from the ladder's point of view, the ladder is sat stationary and the barn is flying towards the ladder very quickly. And so then, as the ladder sees it, the ladder is still 10 feet long. And the barn that would have been 8 feet long if it were stationary is in fact even shorter than 8 feet long because it's moving very quickly relative to the ladder. And from that point of view, it seems impossible that the ladder could fit in the barn. So the way to try and understand this is to break it down into events and think, well, what does it mean to fit inside a barn? It means that there's an event where the front end of the ladder is at a certain position inside the barn at a time when at that same time, the back end of the ladder is at some other position also inside the barn. And then when you break it down like this, you see that the flaw is in assuming this idea that events are simultaneous. So what you'd claim is a simultaneous event depends on your relative motion. That's how the paradox is resolved. But it tells you that you need to get your head around a lot of these concepts. You need to be thinking in terms of these events, points in space and time, and that helps you clarify things. From there, we typically try and describe the universe in terms of special relativity. People often give the analogy of a loaf of bread and say, well, usually we slice the bread in the usual way, and each of those slices is like an instant in time and all the points in space. So the bread is then the universe. But when you move relative to something else, you can slice at a different angle. So it's still the same loaf of bread you're slicing, but now you're slicing it differently because space and time get mixed up when you start having relative motion. But there's a philosopher of physics in Oxford called Julian Barber, who's thought a lot about these things. And he points out again that there are extra assumptions going into that that we might find philosophically pleasing, but aren't actually required by the physics. He gives this alternative explanation as to how you might think of things. Julian Barber would suggest that it's a better way to think of the universe as photographs in a box. So each of the photographs is an instant, and we could imagine it being a snapshot of space, say. But the photographs don't have anything between them. They're a sequence of instances. Now, it might be like the frames in a film that you'd watch in the cinema. As long as you're seeing 24 frames in a second, then you're seeing essentially continuous motion, and we couldn't distinguish between that and a truly smoothly flowing time. But Barber makes the point that actually there's nothing requiring you to even put the photographs in order as they are in a film, because each photograph contains the instant, but also to have, say, your consciousness and so your memories of the past and your predictions about the future and that kind of thing. You could jumble the photographs up into a different order and that'd still be true. You might try to order them from past to future by saying, well, as I progress towards the future, I create more memories and there are fewer things that are left for me to affect, say. But there's nothing that actually requires you to put all those photographs in order. You could just say, well, they're in a jumbled mess, but the instances are still the same as before I jumbled them. And I suppose you could say, I could always look at them and work out what the order is. So do I need to put them in order? It's a really interesting philosophical point he's making there, I think. And that was one of the things I was talking about. But I think it's a nice idea to examine what it is that we actually need to rely on in physical theories and which things we just believe in for philosophical reasons that we haven't necessarily examined. So you might object and say, well, there is an ordering to these photographs, and so what are you talking about? And if you think of points along a line, say your life is along some line and you want to order it from past to future, and you tick a frame along at a time. So you could say, well, that gives an obvious ordering, so isn't this photograph thing wrong? But you could say, well, all you have at each instant is your set of memories and your conscious experience of that instant. And then you think you move forwards along the line, and then you have a slightly bigger set of memories. But an equally valid interpretation of all this is that you start at the end of your life and run backwards through the frames. And as you tick through the frames, your set of memories decreases. At each instant, you're still thinking you can affect the things that are in your future and you can't affect the things in your past. That doesn't change. Your conscious experience would be identical. So the point is that there isn't any evidence that distinguishes these two cases. I'm recording this at home in Bristol in my home office, and my dog, Jeffrey, a black Labrador, is sat here with me. So he will occasionally be making grunts and noises as he moves around. He's quite happy. In fact, you could go further and say, well, you don't have to flow through them in either direction. You could just be jumping randomly between the points. And at each instant, you'll have a set of memories and a set of things you think you can affect and a set of things you think you are affecting in that instant. And that'll be true however you move through this set or if you don't move through them at all. So Barber has devoted a lot of thought to trying to explain why it is that things appear to flow as they do, given that it doesn't otherwise seem to be mandated. And this brings you naturally to the idea of entropy and disorder in physics, because our way of understanding why we flow from past to future, or not necessarily why, but how we quantify that, is that we say that things become more disordered or the entropy increases as we go from past to future. So if we watch a video of somebody dropping an egg and the egg breaking, then we know whether the video has been played forwards or backwards because we see eggs break, but we never see eggs unbreak, for example. This is encoded in the second law of thermodynamics, which says that the entropy of the universe, the amount of disorder, increases spontaneously, and it doesn't decrease, at least on average, overall. And it's an interesting fact that, by and large, the only law of physics that contains this direction of time that distinguishes forward from backwards is the second law of thermodynamics. All other things, such as Newton's laws of motion or even quantum mechanics, seem to be perfectly happy to run forwards or backwards. If you find some physical behavior that's allowed according to the equations of motion in one direction of time, then if you reverse time, you get an equally valid solution. The main thing I got from the workshop was this idea of thinking of time not as flowing, but as individual events seemed to strike a chord with people working in other fields. If you want to stay on firm footing in physics, you end up inevitably breaking things down into events and not necessarily speculating that the events flown between or connected smoothly. And this is an old idea. It's probably what Zeno of Elea was talking about with the famous Zeno's paradoxes. So it's nothing new to physics. It's just interesting that we haven't at any point seemingly added some requirement that there is a flow between these things. As far as we know, Zeno was probably correct. And it was interesting to hear a wide range of voices from different fields realizing or commenting that this same thing is true for their field, that perhaps some of the issues can be avoided by just saying, well, there are isolated events, and perhaps sometimes adding in things such as flow between them can cause confusion or can be unhelpful.
That brings us to the end of this podcast. Thank you for listening. Do join us next time when we hear from performance artist Martin O'Brien from Queen Mary University, London, on living beyond predicted life expectancy in what he calls zombie time. I'm Patricia King-Ori, and you've been listening to After the End, brought to you by the Ethos Centre at the University of Oxford, funded by the Wellcome Discovery Award Scheme. Please share this episode on and subscribe to the series wherever you get your podcasts. You can find more information about the After the End project on our website at www.afterTheEnd.squarespace.com.